It does not take long for weeds to take over one's garden. The same could be said for how quickly fast food can take over one's diet. And that leads us to ask, how does fast food displace good food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1244th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in Acadalia who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, most everyone who has planted a garden knows how quickly weeds can move in and take over the garden. Why, if you were to take a couple of weeks off and for a summer vacation, you'd likely come home to a weed patch. The same can be said for how quickly fast food can displace good food in a community's diet. And nowhere is this phenomenon more pronounced than in California's Great Central Valley, where much of the nation's good food is grown, processed, and shipped to people around the world. Many of the people who live and work in the wonderful California Garden of Eden do not eat the food they grow, but are much more likely to eat the foods of the nation's fast food chains. Consider the findings of a recent study of student eating habits at the University of California, Merced. 80% of students select food for its price, 75% for its convenience, 70% for its familiarity, culture, and identity, and 60% say they eat at their favorite restaurant because they find it to be comforting. From this survey, it's pretty safe to say that good foods grown in the Central Valley have been displaced by fast foods in the diets of the Valley's students. That the fast food weeds have taken over the California Garden of Eden leads us to ask, how does fast food displace good food? Who better to ask than the professor who conducted the study of Central Valley student diets? She is Catherine Keske, professor of agriculture and resource economics and policy at the University of California, Merced. She's also the author of a very interesting white paper called Fast Food is Comforting, but in low-income areas, it crowds out fresher options. Catherine, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me, Michael. My pleasure.
Fun to have you aboard and a very interesting topic to me. How does fast food displace good food? Well, first of all, how does a professor of agriculture and resource economics and policy spend her days?
Well, you know, that's a really mysterious question because a lot of people don't know how professors spend their time. It's a, and especially during these COVID-19 days. So we teach, we at UC Merced are working primarily with at least the undergraduates, first-generation students, and among the brightest in California. And we are teaching classes through Zoom these days. And then in terms of our research programs, the study that you mentioned took place with those very same undergraduate students when we could actually meet in person and distribute surveys. But these days, our research our research mechanisms are a little bit tenuous, let's just say, and we're just limping along with our research. So I spend my days teaching and researching and trying to stay safe.
One of the things I saw on your website was that in your research, you use both qualitative and quantitative analysis. Would you describe those to us?
Sure. So qualitative and quantitative analyses are on different paradigms, and a lot of times they're not combined, and certainly it's not typical for an economist like myself. My PhD is in ag and resource econ. I was primarily trained in quantitative, which involves empirical analyses, number crunching, but with economics, you know, there's a great deal of dissent among economists. And the way we interpret our statistics and the way we interpret our numbers, has to do with, economic intuition. But what I try to do is qualitative analysis. And that is, I try to look at the situation and look at the maybe conducting interviews, listening to voices of people, maybe in this particular case, a segment of the population that is food insecure. And that helps me target where I'm crunching my data. So qualitative analysis, a lot of times those are methods used in sociology, psychology at times. But quantitative analyses, that's a lot of times when you just look at, let's say, GDP growth, unemployment values. That's a lot of times configured or determined by quantitative analysis.
Maybe by using both, you can get over, what was it Mark Twain said about statistics?
Yes. Damn lies, something like that.
Lies, damn lies, and statistics, right? So maybe if you use both kinds of ways of looking at things, you can get to a much deeper truth than if you just use one. And that would be the hope, I guess. So you did this wonderful article that I ran across and found most fascinating. It was titled, Fast Food is Comforting, but in Low-Income Areas, it Crowds Out Fresher Options. Now, what led you to do this study?
Sure. Part of my research program, as I mentioned, I'm trained as an agricultural economist, but part of my research program involves looking at underserved communities and food insecurity. So part of my time as a scholar before I came to UC Merced, I lived in a very poor, impoverished region in Canada called Newfoundland and Labrador. Now, our neighbor to the north, I think we hold in really high regard. We think of Canadians as polite and actually a very developed country, much like the United States. But like the United States, there are regions of Canada that are very food insecure, and a lot of this is due to climate, that these areas are so cut off from the rest of Canada, or the weather, or I should say or the weather, makes it difficult for them to grow their own food. So the province where I served as a professor, and I still do research with them, it's called Newfoundland and Labrador, really fascinating area. Those of you who are, those of your listeners might just have a good time going down that rabbit hole and learning about this unusual and kind of far off peripheral area of North America. But Newfoundland and Labrador was first colonized back in the 1400s because they had these huge cod, just amazing. If you've seen these photos of amazing cod, that's where this was caught. And those of your listeners who grew up eating fish sticks in the 50s and the 60s, that cod was caught in the waters of Newfoundland and Labrador. So an area that was, in one hand, very abundant in a food source, but that led to exploitation, and the international trade really depleted this very rich food source. And because of climatic conditions, Newfoundland and Labrador that province has become very food insecure. And there's a trend that we see among harsh climates or underserved communities, which is what Newfoundland and Labrador has become, that it's become increasingly reliant on commercial prepackaged food. Mm-hmm. So now let's shift to California's Central Valley. Totally different climate. I think it's probably, close to 100 degrees, if not a little bit more today when we're taping. Different climate, but the parallels are quite similar.
Well, so just a minute, though, because California's Great Central Valley is, gosh, the breadbasket of the world almost in many respects, not necessarily for bread, but a lot of the fresh food, the fruits and vegetables. So how could anybody possibly be hungry there?
Well, that's right. And that's the irony with the study region I just mentioned, these great, huge, just fish that actually brought cod to North America, and it's being depleted. the parallel with the Central Valley is that, like you said, it feeds the world. How could anybody be, how could they go without? So the food, as we all know from the Central Valley, is being sold elsewhere for a higher price. The food chain, the supply chain, which I know is a lot of the focus of your work, Michael, the supply chain moves that food outside. In the meantime, we see the patterns of those who actually produce the food start the, oh, please, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, with respect to Nova Scotia and Halifax and whatnot, you know, they had this abundant source of cod, but not much else. And, you know, if you're working in, for example, the strawberry fields of California, I guess you would have a lot of strawberries to eat, but not much else. So there's that parallel as well.
Yeah, I think the parallel that you're driving at, where we see the similarities in the labor forces, is that when you're producing a lot of a crop, like you're saying strawberries and you're saying Atlantic Canada with the fish.
A lot of any one thing, right?
Right, right. That any one thing is being exported. And what do you do with the money? You know, the money that you make, because you're working all day, you're trying to buy that something else. Now, in an earlier time, let's say 50 years ago, 75 years ago, there was time to make that something else. People raised gardens, so they were able to supplement what, in addition to the crops that they were producing. We don't see the home food production, as you know, like we once did. And that's very true of the people who are, let's say, working the fields in the Central Valley. They work, they pick, but there's not time to prepare their own food. Or maybe they want a break, or they have other obligations like childcare that prohibits them from their own home food preparation. So it's a couple of things. One, it's that we're creating these large, like you were saying, large mass production of crops and sending them elsewhere. And then we're not able to focus on our own food production that kind of rounds out our own like food consumption. And instead, we're relying on pre-prepared meals like fast food, like food that you buy at the grocery store instead of food you're raising or preparing at home.
So in many respects, we could be right in the middle of land of plenty and working and growing all that food and be starving for food because we really don't have access to that food. We don't
That's
have
right.
We don't have the money to buy it. We don't have the time to prepare it. And so we turn to what we can eat, which tends to be from a fast food franchise. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this, the 1244th edition of the Food Chain, with Professor Catherine Keske, an ag economist from the University of California, Merced, and right in the heart of California's great Central Valley. When we come back, I'd like to ask Catherine about her survey of the student diets and how they've changed and become fast food eaters. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Catherine, when it came down to finding some subjects to study with respect to the diets of the California's Great Central Valley, you had a whole bunch of them right there before you as students at the University of Merced. Tell us about the student population there at UC Merced, please.
Sure. So the UC Merced student population, it's a really resilient bunch. Those listeners who aren't familiar with UC Merced, it's the 10th campus of the University of California, established in, well, depending upon how you count it, 2003 or 2004. But the students tend to be students who are California natives, And a lot of the students, about a third, come from the Central Valley, about a third from Southern California, about a third from Northern California. We, compared to the rest of the UC campuses, have a lot more first-generation and students who come from low-income families. So very motivated, very talented, very resilient students, but disproportionately from families who are lower income.
So probably a lot of those families that were lower income were farm worker families, correct?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So they, you know, it must be a great honor for them to, I guess, when I was a kid, I was a teenage herbicide myself. And when I got to the University of California and had the privilege of studying English and Chinese literature, I thought, how wonderful it is for me to be so far away from hoeing weeds in the field. And do your students feel that same way? Do they have that
Yes.
same appreciation?
Our students are very grounded. They have that appreciation. They are... I've been a professor for almost 20 years, and they are among the sweetest, most earnest people, students that I've ever encountered. And I think it's because they have gratitude. And I think they are also, many of the students see themselves, they come to university as a path to make themselves better and to make their families better off. So it's, I think the way you described your own perspective is very much the perspective of most UC Merced undergraduate students.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to hear. You know, what a wonderful gift for America to give those kids and their parents and everybody to give them the opportunity. And that's what America is all about. You did.
And I want to jump in real quick.
Yeah, go
ahead. I feel it's a gift for me to actually be a professor there. And it's a gift for me to actually work with those students on a daily basis. So didn't mean to interrupt you, but you were talking about gifts, and I just had to put it out there that it's a real gift to be on the faculty.
Good. So you had a chance to look at their diet, and you came up with some very interesting findings. I thought we'd go through them because in many respects, it sounds like all student diets. You know, when you're a college student, I remember living on peanut butter and jelly for quite a while, and surplus cheese and whatever else I could get my hands on. But so let's go through how the kids look at their diets. At 80% select food for its price. Well, of course, isn't that true with all kids?
I would say so. And just for comparison, those who are listening might be interested in looking at the University of California Office of the President has done a study on food security. And so UCOP, UCOP, you can look up food security or food insecurity and see the entire system, the UC system's evaluation of undergraduate students. But that fortifies your point, Michael. Like, isn't that typical of all students that age? And I would say, yes, that's typical of all students that age.
So that puts them in average bucket, in my estimation, having been a student and having watched students, you know. This is something interesting, though. 75% select food for convenience, which is to say, I'm very busy. I don't have time for anything superfluous like eating. So whatever passes by my face, I'm going to grab and eat. That rings
true? Yeah. Well, the way you described it rings true. And what we don't have the context of is how that 75% compares to the rest of the student population through the UC system.
Ah.
But that 75% who base their decisions on convenience, it's very representative of people or people, everybody, not everybody, but people from low-income communities, people from low-income households don't have time. And so making food choices based on convenience what we see from that 75%, it's very much a parallel to low-income households.
And why is it that low-income households have less time than households with more money?
Well, it is the responsibility of running a household has been kind of diverted. Or how do I say this? Food preparation isn't as much a part of a normal household operating. I'm not articulating this super well, Michael. I'm going to try it again. Low-income households don't have the time for food preparation. Many times they're working multiple jobs just to keep, just to pay the bills. There's childcare, and certainly we've seen that now with the COVID-19 pandemic. Our data were collected before, but my point being is childcare, multiple jobs, sometimes multiple generations within a household makes it difficult to do food preparation, and you're basing your food decisions on convenience.
What about single parent family households? Is that a big part of your student demographic?
Oh, that's a great question. We didn't explicitly look to see if we had single parent households. We didn't look to see if we had single parents who were also students. Now, based on what I know about the demographics at UC Merced, I would say that's fairly, it's not a large demographic like it might be at community colleges. But we do know single-parent households are very food insecure, and this is something we see in North America, and we see that across the world. So that is a risk factor for being food insecure, is if you're a single-parent household. And it comes back to what we were talking about, time. Time for food preparation isn't there if you are wearing so many hats that makes that household function.
Which, of course, if you have a single family household, time is very, very precious, I would suspect, because you're working to make money, maybe two or three jobs, and then you're taking care of the household and then feeding everybody. And I don't know how anybody could possibly do that, but people do that. The next number was kind of really fascinating to me. 70% choose food for its familiarity, which is to say, I recognize that food. Well, that's kind of human nature, is it not? Where mother teaches us what to eat and what not to eat, and we remember what mother taught us all through our lives. So isn't that part of that, I don't know, branding that goes on with respect to food?
Exactly. Exactly. And we see the messages that are sent to children. I mean, this has been a topic of discussion for decades about the messages through commercials, through YouTube and through society. Fast food has become quote unquote normal or normalized by our society. And, you know, the days of mom making a decision and the family eating what mom puts on the table, those days are gone. Now, there are many, many contributors to household food, right? Like, it's not just one person in the family or one member, and we're not just talking about a nuclear family where there was a mom and dad. But the fact of the matter is there's a lot more individual decision-making that goes into food, and the technology is such that more individuals can decide what to purchase and the convenience of that food. So we're talking food that's not as nutritional. That's become available to children who have in turn become consumers and who make choices that may not be what, let's say, quote unquote, mom would have served them back in 1940. So Yeah.
You know, I had a recent conversation with Heidi Diestel, whose family owns the Diestel Turkey Company. And we were talking about her children. She has young children. And I asked her about how she teaches her children about food. And she said, we cook dinner together and talk about it. Now, if there's not a mom there to cook the dinner and talk about what she's doing and how she's doing it and why she's doing it, there is no, probably not going to be anybody. So who is left to talk about what you should eat except television or friends or whatever? But who is there to talk about the nutrition and what's in the food and so on? So I can see what you're saying, that you have now have the freedom to choose whatever you want, but where do you get the information to base your decisions on?
Yeah, I think the point that you're making, whether that's, you know, mom or dad, or let's say an uncle or a grandmother, you know, a family, you know, what we would say is family food heritage, some of that food knowledge can be lost or has been lost. And I think now is maybe a good time to point out that this study, or the data were collected for my article, the data were collected last fall and early this spring. We stopped data collection in February, quite frankly, because the pandemic was closing around us. So this is pre-pandemic data. I think that there might be, like, this is one of the opportunities that with the self-isolation or the sheltering in place, we can regain that teaching or that food knowledge, and actually walking our family members through food preparation together, and creating our own family traditions. So to your point, your conversation with Heidi, and it sounds like amazing. I'll have to go back to your archives and listen to that. I think we do have an opportunity to change what's familiar. And it's interesting, I think, with this study done fairly recently, but still in some ways, still kind of like a point in time that is totally changed.
Next point you make in your statistics here, 60% of students select the restaurant because they find it comforting. Now, there's a lot in that one. Comforting.
Yes. Comforting, yes. And that is, how do I say, the questions that we asked around comfort and fast food, that is part of our, I would call it, our unique contribution to the literature, and that it's well known that food choices, people base their food selection based on comfort, but we're really making the connection that it's the fast food restaurants and that familiarity that provide comfort to people. And if you kind of think about it, when during the pandemic, the lines that you might see of cars lined up to the fast food restaurants, this familiarity of going to a restaurant, even if that restaurant is a fast food restaurant, provided a sense of quote unquote normalcy to people. So yeah, that's our unique contribution to the literature, if you would.
You know, speaking of literature and comforting, I'm reminded of a Ernest Hemingway short story entitled A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. And, you know, if you're on your own, as students really are, and you're out there in the world, a clean, well-lighted place that looks pretty much like exactly the same one down the street from where you grew up would be comforting. And you know, I find that too when I'm out traveling in the world. You could always go to a mall, and it's just like the last mall you were in, so you had that comfort. So do you think
what you're describing? Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Oh, no. I think what you've described, Michael, is a lot of it relates to what's called like a third place. And the type of environment that is comforting and maybe a little bit, it makes you reminisce about earlier times. But yeah, it's a place of comfort, and it can be familiar to you and of your childhood. But fast food restaurants have that also.
And in that way, I guess those are some of the ways that fast food does displace good foods in the community's diet. But there must be some way for good food to displace bad food in the community's diet. And when we come back with Catherine Keske, that's what we're going to explore. How can good food displace bad food? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Professor Catherine Keske, ag economist, University of California, Merced, and you right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, Professor Keske, in looking at, the impoverished peoples of the world, you must have scratched your head and thought, how can we bring good food into these poor diets? Do you have any ideas?
Well, I have ideas, but I don't know whether they're going to be the real fix, so to speak. I guess I would say is these might be suggestions that people can implement in their households and then bring it to the community level. And I would hope that we can scale it up and create new habits.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
where do we start?
Go, please. Well, I think one thing is, there's no better time than right now to start a new tradition within one's own household, because we've been forced to change our habits, and we are with our families more than we were, for most of us, compared to 8 months ago, in terms of our routines are different. The time that we spent commuting, many people, that's time that they are spending at home. And so creating, I know a lot of people have created their COVID-19 victory gardens. Creating your own, I guess, household food supply or your household food supply chain, and ensuring that those are foods that you feel your household can predictably rely on and that are nutritious, but also your family has a hand in preparation. So kind of back to this comfort idea, the process of preparing food, and that might also be the process of growing it, can in fact become comforting to your own family. And I think now's a great time to reestablish that. So that's one suggestion. I think a second suggestion is, and it's something else that we discussed in the article, is that who owns the food, the fast food restaurants? Usually the fast food restaurants are owned by companies that are outside of the community. In fact, the companies are usually very wealthy. And so at the community level, trying to keep the food ownership local will play a tremendous part of the food remaining available at the local community level. So there's different solutions to that. I think as a household, you can support small business and try to keep those organizations or those small businesses alive by, I guess now we would say carry out, but ideally community sourced gardens or community sourced agriculture or local, let's say, poultry production, local egg production, keeping those businesses, giving them your money and creating that maybe a new routine, having milk delivered to your door or having eggs delivered to your door would ensure that food is available locally. Those are some ideas. Perhaps you have other ideas, Michael.
I do. And Now that I have a professor of ag economy on the line, I would like to put my idea on the table and have you shoot some holes in it for me, okay?
Okay.
My idea is that we can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and we won't have to ask the government for help. And as a matter of fact, Catherine, I believe it will be so easy, it will make you blush. I call it the 2x2 pledge. First, here's the first two. All you have to remember are two numbers. One is 2 and the other is 2-2. The first two. I pledge to spend $2 per day on local food. I always call that food with its farmer's face on it, which simply means that I know where it came from. I have an idea where it was grown and how it was grown. And since we have to buy food anyway, all of us have to buy food, it won't cost us any money, and $2 per day is not much money, less than an energy drink at the convenience store. But for that $2 a day, we're going to get real food. Now, does that make sense?
I think it's making a deliberative decision. Absolutely makes sense.
Okay, so far so good then. Here's my second two of the 2x2 pledge. I pledge to convince two other people to spend $2 per day on local food. Okay? Now, that means I become kind of like a proselytizer in that I have to go out and convince two other people to spend $2 per day on local food. Now, it shouldn't be all that difficult to find two other people to do that because everybody has to buy food. And it will mean that those people that I talk into will have to do a little bit of extra work to find food with its farmer's face on it. They'll have to look around and open their eyes, and they'll have to explore, and they'll have to meet people and ask them questions. But if you think about it, they'll be able to establish a relationship with real people who grow real food. And you know, that might not be a bad thing to have these days, is that connection with the food chain. So that's my other two. Now, if I succeed in talking two other people into doing this, which means they have to find two other people too, right? And they have to find two other people and so on. So what if we can convince everybody in the marketplace, in our community, to spend $2 per day on local food? Now, tough job, but I think it could be done. Now, let's run the numbers here. $2 per day from 500,000 residents, let's say, is $1 million per day in a local economy. Now, that's a lot of money in cold, hard cash circulating around the community. But I've been told and have read and kind of even have an experience in this. When you buy something for $1 and take that dollar and buy something from your neighbor for $1, that's $1 has generated $2 worth of business. So it's said that money generated locally circulates 7 times before it disappears. So if that's true, our $365 million per year would equal about $2.5 billion a year in local money. Now, I said I had a little experience with this and have. As a matter of fact, I'm part of an organization called Think Local First. And to demonstrate the efficacy of thinking local first, we talked 5 of our local banks into giving us 5 $100 checks. And we took those checks and gave them away at a mixer that we had. And then we asked them to take those 5 $100 checks and spend them at a locally owned business. And so on. And we followed those checks for 30 days. And in 30 days, those five $100 checks generated approximately $8,900 worth of business. So it doesn't seem out of reason to me that money would circulate seven times. And if it does, there's a lot of money in a local economy. Now, with all that money circulating, the farmers are going to have to hire people to work on their farms. They're going to have to buy goods and services from local merchants. And by doing this, we're all going to discover how good this healthy food is for us. We're going to enjoy it because it's not just the food. It has a whole culture around it now, a community around it, a celebration of it. So it's going to become very important to us. And instead of spending $2 a day on local food, we might end up spending $10 a day on local food. And if we did, that would be a $12.5 billion a year industry that we've manufactured with nothing, without spending an extra dime, or without asking the federal government for any help at all. And just by focusing the money that we have to spend on our local community and the food that we can produce from that community, we can really displace the bad food with a good food and a good community, and a community that's perfectly capable of taking care of itself. Now that I have an ag economist, you can tell me where I'm wrong.
Well, that's, first of all, I would say in general, directionally, you're absolutely right. That the way to ensure that resources are available for community is to invest in the goods and services that are local, and to spend your money on the businesses that show the values that you share. So in directionally, you're absolutely correct. I wouldn't be a very good economist if I didn't say, you know, number crunching is important, in the sense that, you know, you want to make sure that wherever you're spending your money, that those businesses are also spending their money locally. But what you're describing, and that's a lot of the work you've done, is the supply chain. And so if all the supply chain remains local, you're absolutely on the right track.
Mm-hmm. So as part of the education that we all have to do, right, is that we have to sell others on the need to think local, to buy that, to spend money on your local food.
Precisely.
And if we all have that in our mind, then, you know, the fact that the large corporations can get a better price might not mean that it's a better deal for the community.
That's right. That's right. And there's something to food security as being a public good. And, you know, if I would, you know, I'd sort of prompt your listeners to explore the feelings that they felt earlier this year when shelves were bare and or maybe a specific item that they were looking for wasn't available. If it was locally generated, would that item have been available? I mean, I don't have the answer, but certainly that's part of this idea of food security and the public good that food security provides. So if you're investing locally, there's an argument to be made that you're controlling the local availability.
Yes, and you're also building a community as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. It becomes part of the community culture, which is what you are, I think, what a big part that you're driving at. So if it's part of the community culture, one could argue it becomes your normal to you. And so instead of some of the quote-unquote you know, less desirable food pathways, having a community sustained food supply becomes normal and hence comforting.
Mm-hmm. You know, what you expressed about the comforting nature of fast food restaurants, so that clean, well-lighted place, reminds me of how I feel when I'm at a farmer's market and watching all of the people drift from booth to booth, and the negotiation and the smiles and the food and whatnot. Compare that society, that culture, to shopping at the big box store, where people have their head down and they're moving quickly and furtively from place to place. It's just a whole different world.
Yeah. And to sort of balance this out, though, the reality is there are people who may not be as fortunate as you and I to be able to go to the farmer's market when the farmer's market is being held. You know, maybe it's their turn to watch all of the children,
right,
or it's their turn to fix the washing machine. But in that sense, I think the convenience aspect of the big box stores has reigned, the convenience aspect. So if we can try to make, as a community, some resources convenient, I think that'll solve a lot of the issues that low-income communities or low-income households suffer from. So, you know, for example, one of my students came up with an idea of a business plan for a babysitting cooperative. Some of those babysitting cooperatives work, some don't, but that would be an example of a way to free up time for people, and it makes a community level.
Yes, and speaking of time, we just ran out, but Professor Catherine Keske, University of California, Merced, thank you so much for joining me, and thank you so much for pointing the holes in my 2x2 pledge. I'll have to figure out how to patch them. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.